This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey folks, in anticipation of Dune Part 2 coming to theaters on March 1st, we are rerunning our Adaptation Nation episode where Jeff talked with our former co-workers Jen and Amanda about the first installment of Dune. Hope you enjoy, and we can't wait to hear what you think about Dune Part 2 when it's out in a few weeks.
Do you often dream things that happen just as you dream them?
Yes.
The test is simple. Remove your hand from the box, and you die.
What's in the box?
Pain.
Welcome to the inaugural episode of Adaptation Nation. Today, with this episode, we're doing Dune, the cultural monolith, the idea of sci-fi, one of the biggest properties in all of American culture for sure, makes its third major adaptation attempt this month with Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Frank Herbert's 1960. Oh, on my notes, help me, Jen or Amanda, 1962?
64?
We're terrible. I have no
65,
idea.
65.
65 novel Dune, which then spiraled into what can you only say is a sprawling mess of a franchise with 19 books in the Dune series written by Frank and then his son Brian and various adaptations and graphic novels and expansion standard universe. These things happen, but we're going to get into especially the original first novel and then the most recent adaptation here and see what we can learn, see what we can find. I think all three of us have interesting relationship. I'm here with Amanda Nelson and Jen Northington. We're going to get into Dune in all the different kinds of ways, but I guess I want to start here. We've had it's been out for a week now, available. And Rebecca and I were talking about this a little bit on the Book Riot podcast yesterday, but I think we can say that Dune is having a moment. Like, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Is that what you're seeing? What are you guys seeing out there in the world of Dune and culture? What's your experience of how the wider world is experiencing it?
I don't think most of the people in my life who are not readers are seeing it, which is not the case for most adaptations that I can remember, except for Lord of the Rings. So I think it's definitely having like a moment.
Yeah, I think it's got that this is a big sci-fi epic feel to it. And people are very open to that aesthetic right now. So I don't think it matters so much to the general population that it's an adaptation so much as that it's a great big movie with a lot of stars they've probably heard of.
And I haven't done any, I've tried to avoid all commentary on the movie itself because I'd like to not be polluted by it. And the only people I know that have seen it, y'all, I've seen it, Michelle's seen it, my partner, and then a couple of my friends who I kind of primed, because they're good pop culture consumers, but they didn't know anything about Dune. I'm like, are you going to watch this? Are you excited? What do you think about it? And I said, would you please tell me what you think? And I'll put that to the second. But in your estimation, is this a thing? Is it in the zeitgeist because it's good, because it's interesting, because it's a mess? Like, do people like Dune right now?
The movie or the concept?
Yeah, the movie.
I think that there are the reactions from people who have read the book and who are into Dune the book are different than the reactions of people who don't know what Dune is going in. It seems like people who like the book are more critical of this version.
right.
than everyone else.
Which is not, I mean, that's a bit of a dog bites man story,
right?
For book adaptations on the whole.
But for something with a budget this big, I think that that's noticeable. That's notable, yeah.
I don't remember. I mean, the big adaptation, the biggest adaptation of like my pulp culture, that's an interesting Freudian slip, pop culture life, I think I have to, it has to be Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring in 2001. Yeah. You know, I'm the exact right age to be like a cultural consumer. It's a book I read as a kid. And also the, I guess we would have to say the early, if not inciting stage of these giant fantasy spec fic IP becoming becoming the center of popular culture. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I think people like me who like the book like those movies. So it's not inevitable, but it is maybe more common to have like somewhere between nitpicking and full-throated critiques of that, you know, the resulting property here. And this just seems to be somewhere between from where I'm going to land is it's not a mess. I'm also not, this is the definitive Dune I've always been looking for my whole life. So I guess let's not do too much of that right now, but let's talk about our relationship to the book. Initially here. Jen and I talked a little bit on our foundation show we did for SFF. Yeah. Amanda, I haven't talked to you at all about Dune. Tell me about your pre-existing condition with Dune.
I read Dune in high school because a boyfriend told me to, which I say with much, much shame. But, you know, most of y'all know my backstory, my literary backstory by now, but I read almost entirely classics for most of my reading life until my kind of mid-20s, really. And so in high school, that's exactly what I was doing. I was reading a lot of mid-century American fiction, and the guy that I was dating at the time, who I eventually married and had children with, was very military sci-fi only. Like, we both had our, this is the only thing that I read. And I was like, well, if you want to be with me, you have to read this Dickens. And he was like, same, but Dune. And I was like, fine. So I read it, and I loved it. I loved it in high school. I read all of them. I have read the entire of the ones written by Frank Herbert. I have not read any of the ones by his son because I don't care. But I read all of the Herbert ones. So, and that took me, you know, years, because of course it did.
You might have to be our what happens later on oracle here, because I think my memory is very cloudy. I remember loving Dune. And then on my reread, I really like Dune. I still like the first book. I really like Dune. But I have no idea what happens next. I don't remember anything. In Children of Dune is next, or is it Dune Messiah next? I don't even remember this at this point.
Children of Dune. I don't remember the order. I could tell you the plot points, but I don't remember the titles.
Right. Well, let's come back to that when we get maybe towards the end, as people who are encountering Dune for the first time are like wondering where this could lead if things go well. We know Dune Part 2, which is really the... I guess it really is Dune Part 2. The second, I didn't really look at the page break of where we kind of leave, but there's going to be another movie of Book 1, and then we're going to expand out from Book 2 and beyond. Jen, remind people who maybe listened to us before or have never encountered us before, what was your pre-existing condition with Dune?
Yeah, I read it as a kid who was obsessed with sci-fi and fantasy of all stripes. So inevitably, somebody was going to give me Dune, or I was going to find it on
just
my
a matter
own.
Of time.
It was just a matter of time. And I believe I read at least half of the second one, which is Dune Messiah, but I never revisited it. And I certainly didn't finish or continue on with that series.
Right.
And then I reread when they made the big, this is happening, and here's, you know, our director announcement for this movie. I reread the book for an episode of SFF that we did with Asma Zahanat Khan, who is an amazing writer and also a big fan of the book, who has her own, you know, relationship to it as a Muslim Arab woman. And so we did a podcast about it. So that was my first reread of Dune since I read it as a teenager.
We're going to talk about that, some of the issues brought up in that episode. We'll link it in the show notes too, which you can find. And I think we have some other supporting materials that will for if you're doing further reading on it as well. My own is very similar. I think I read this when I was 13, which is now 30 years ago, which seems just mind-bogglingly wild. And I can see why I liked it then. I think I like it for different reasons now. Mm. Here's a thing that's weird to think about. So when I read it, if I was 13 when I read this, that would have been 1991. And for those of us who grew up on Star Wars, this was the great arid period in Star Wars land. Like, if Star Wars for me and a lot of people my age was like the big sci-fi, really the big like nerd culture franchise, right? But between 1983 and 1999, we had nothing. There was like you got to read some Timothy Zahn novels, maybe have fun with that. Like, and so we were looking for where to go. And where we went was Dune and Foundation and Philip K. Dick and some of that stuff like that. not realizing, because you didn't do this kind of research at the time, even someone like me, that Star Wars is like kind of a skin on top of Dune in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So you're like, what? Wait, another story? We have weird mind power set on a spice planet, you know, on a desert planet. Like, what is this? But it was one of the things we were going to there as well. And I remember, I must have been like you, Jen, of starting. I can't imagine I didn't read a subsequent book. That would have been completely unlike me.
Right.
And I think I must have just petered out. I must have Divergent franchised it, which I was like, you know what? I can't, I can't go on. And I think that is also important to know about the cultural place of Dune is like, people know the end of Lord of the Rings. People know the end of, I don't know, what are the other big ones? We're talking about Star Wars or things like that. People don't know the end of Dune. They don't, I can't even remember. And so I think that's been a burden on it to become something that is Lord of the Rings shaped or even Game of Thrones shaped or something like that, because it kind of peters out. It gets really weird into this sprawling mess, which I think is interesting, but it doesn't lend itself to franchise making. And I think makes it for a high degree of difficulty once you get beyond the last page of the first volume. So that's our initial personal experiences. Let's take a moment here and think about and give some context for the original book.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of 7 stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truth about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's best books of the year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young Duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young Duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com. And catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hiro to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hiro's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com. And catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Who would like to start talking about the book itself, the backstory? I've got some notes. Anyone have anything that they particularly struck them in reading about the backstory of Dune, the book?
The Kennedy thing. I can't get over this.
All right, Amanda, take
I'm sorry. I know I interrupted you there, but
that's fine.
So I knew when I read the book as a teenager, I knew that Herbert was some kind of conservative political figure, but I never read any further into it. And it turned out he was like a Republican operative, like a very heavily involved with the GOP Nixon supporter. And the Dune series, not the first book, but the whole series is essentially an indictment of Kennedy democracy. Kennedy as a
neoliberalism, figure. Sort of like mid-century democratic politics.
And this, cult of personality, white savior, liberal dude. It's a critique of all of those things, which I think if you only ever read book one, makes no freaking sense whatsoever.
Mm.
No sense because of the way that it ends. But if you keep going, I think it makes more sense. But the Kennedy thing is fascinating to me, that he hated the guy so much and thought that he was so dangerous that he wrote, 20 books about it? Like, I can't get over it.
It is strange. That,
I do think the seeds of that are in book one. I mm-hmm. think that if you are perhaps not paying that much attention, it's easy to see Paul as a hero because that's what you're used to. But mm-hmm. if you actually read Dune, the first book, it's clear that, like, nobody is a hero here. Mm. Like, right. No one is a hero, mm. which is going to show up again in my critiques of the movie. But yeah, I think that I don't think it's explicit. And I do think it's interesting. Amanda, you linked us to this Heresies of Dune book essay from last year that's on LA Review of Books by Daniel Immerwahr. And mm-hmm. it's super fascinating. I mean, you're right. The Kennedy stuff and the political stuff is very interesting. But for me, you know, I do think it's a really interesting book, especially when you consider how it fits into, like, the zeitgeist that also contains Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, because, mm-hmm. like I said, no one is actually a hero here. This is all very nuanced, complicated. Like, I actually think it has more in common with Game of Thrones mm-hmm. than it has with Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, because, you know, Herbert doesn't believe in good versus evil, really. Which is also another critique I have of the movie that we'll talk about later.
Right.
But it's so everything is so complicated. Everybody's playing such a complicated game. Everybody is complicit in some kind of badness
yes.
or violence or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I don't think that gets talked about a right. lot. Like, I think that gets lost in the sort of high key plot points of Dune, which is, you know, coming of age, young boy with special powers, you know, leaves the safety of home to, you know, grow up with an indigenous tribe kind of overarching thing. But you lose so much if that's all that gets talked about, which is often all that gets talked about.
I think that's a great point. And I had a similar note, and we can get to a little later in our different section, but, like, I think Game of Thrones, in terms of complexity, is the closest analog. I mean, yeah. it's not science fiction. It's about something completely different,
right.
except its point of view about humanity, or, you know, I guess being, because we have all sorts of different people from different planets here, is very, very similar. I think that's the thing that made Dune so exciting in the early 60s, right?
Yeah.
It's this wildly complicated. It blends mythology and science and religion and sociology. We should talk, or I want to talk, let me say this, I don't know if I should, about Herbert's, like, influences, right? Because I think it holds up very well, considering, you know, in a lot of ways. And I think for its time, at least in book one, it's taking on complexity about religion and culture and language and philosophy and politics in a way that you just don't really see happening. It's so fascinating to read in connection with, say, Foundation, which is really trying to simplify things. Like, what if there were just this one master discourse called psychohistory, and if you did the math, you could figure it all out? Dune is kind of the opposite, right? It's like, it's all a mess. It's all so interconnected and interlinked. It's like chaos theory of existence, of how things gets put together. And, you know, there's the simple part of the origin story of Dune, and then there's the very complicated part. Like, the simple part that you read in most of these, what's the deal with Dune, is, like, Frank Herbert was writing this story about erosion on the Oregon mm-hmm. coast and sees these dunes. He's like, hey, that's interesting. And he was also doing a, I guess you would call a lot of drugs at the same time, doing hallucinogens and having the, I guess, early to mid-60s, more of a West Coast beatnik kind of experience than later hippiedom that we'd come to find. Remember, this is the early 60s. But the other thing that's going on is he's a libertarian on the West Coast, which is Amanda is alluding to, you sometimes, remember California, Washington, Oregon in the mid-50s and early 60s, they were voting for Republicans, mm-hmm. right? It's a much interesting, much, not only it's more interesting, but it's a different environment than we're used to now in how right and left are put together. And the other thing that's happening, it's in the air, is, you know, nascent environmentalism. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring comes out in 1962. And the early works of academic colonialism are happening at the same time. Franz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth comes out in 1959. And then Black Skin, White Mask come out in 1961. So Herbert wouldn't have read those books. So those things so much inform later colonial studies, not colonialism, that's a different thing. Orientalism by Edward Said, which is sort of the foundational text of modern colonial studies, comes out 17 years later.
Yeah.
So as much as it feels dated, I think it's ahead of its time, but behind ours in a lot of ways, which I think is helpful context. Now, the movie, in its faithfulness, I think now feels behind the times because it doesn't catch up. And I think we can talk about that a little bit more. Some of your discussion that you mentioned earlier, I think Jen touches on this, but there's other ways it does too. The other backstory I think is interesting is, like, you know, I love these stories where it's like 20 publishers passed on it, right? Mm-hmm. 20 publishers passed on this book. This little press in, I think, Philadelphia called Chilton Press picked it up because someone liked it. They were mostly like a DIY, how-to auto repair and knitting sort of publisher. It doesn't earn out, and it takes on this like magical word-of-mouth status. And over the 10 years between 1962 and the early 70s, it becomes, at that time, a cult phenomenon. And then it feels like a long time ago now, but then it's only 20 years between 1964 and 1984 where Lynch's Dune comes out. I mean, that's not that long ago. We're farther away from the Lord of the Rings movies than we are to that, which it feels. So there was a very rapid response there. And it won, you know, the early days of science fiction and fantasy having their own awards. Was it the first Nebula? I'm now looking at my notes.
It was the first Nebula. It was.
One of the first Nebula. And it co-won a Hugo at the same time. But then became, it's now the best-selling science fiction novel of all time. And Jen, I'm embarrassed to say, before I was reading this, if you would have asked me to list the five best sci-fi selling novels of all time, I would have been just mute. I wouldn't even have known where to go. I mean, I guess I was surprised to find that Dune is the best-selling science fiction novel of all time. But if you would ask me, okay, then what is it if it isn't Dune? I wouldn't have an answer. Does that fit in with your own understanding, Jen, of like where it is in terms of the sci-fi American canon especially?
Yeah, I guess so. Now I'm trying to think of like if I could tell you. I mean, it's like it's Asimov, Zelazny, Heinlein, Herbert, and somebody else.
Yeah, I'm not
somebody
sure.
Else. But
a Philip K. Dick anthology, maybe.
Yeah,
or
right, or
like
something.
Yeah.
I mean, not now. That's that. In I'm talking about the context of when the book came out.
Right.
Those were the best-selling authors. Wait, I'm sorry, I forgot the question.
No, but like it's primacy. Does primacy remain? Right? It's not like how foundational is this sort of modern?
I mean,
are sci-fi nerds reading Dune now? Are they starting with Dune now?
I half jokingly referred to it as a sci-fi shibboleth in this piece I wrote that I got assigned to write for Audible about the book versus the movie. Because I really do think it is one. Like, it is not, I don't want to say it's universal among sci-fi fantasy fans, but I do think it is a particular level of sci-fi and fantasy fan. You have read it.
Say more about that. So you mean you're like a greater nerd theory? Like if you have to pass it to get the next level?
If you
or
consider
like
yourself like a sci-fi connoisseur, I think you've read Dune. Like I can't imagine that not being part of your over. If you just like sci-fi and fantasy, maybe you haven't read it. Like perhaps even probably you haven't read it. But if you consider yourself a sci-fi person in particular, I would be surprised if you haven't read Dune.
Hmm. I guess that's a good transition to what's it like to read this book now. Like we can never take off our blinders of having read it before. Amanda, on your reread, what was your impression of Dune the book?
It's so immersive and also pushes you out constantly, which is such a weird reading experience, I think, because you're in it. Like, from the jump, this kid's getting tortured. You're here for, like, this mom freaking out. Like, there's so much going on immediately. And he's pretty good at putting a reader in a world with, like, unrecognizable names and all that kind of stuff, like, centering you in the experience. But then the dialogue is so strange, and they're immediately talking about, like, yeah, but he's a person, but is he a human? And you're like, what? What does that even mean? And they just, they never explain it. And that's how he rolls through the whole book. It's like, there's so many distinctions between, like, moral and ethical distinctions he's making that just read like complete nonsense to me now. But I don't care enough to stop reading it because it's a good story. But I think that the things that Herbert wants you to think about when you're reading it, most people are probably not thinking about because he's a terrible writer of dialogue.
But the dialogue is tough. And I think that comes across in the movie too, to some degree, right? What's the most memorable line from Dune? It's like, fear is the mind killer. What's the next one? Kind of tough.
So I think that's like, it's a weird reading experience because you're in it so, you're in the world so immediately, and for the rest of the thing, and there's like mystery elements, like who were the Fremen, like what's going on here, and you're here for the ride, but the big things he wants you to get, I don't think people are gonna get, or I don't think I got even really, because he's just not, he's not a very good writer in a lot of ways, so.
Yeah, that's, I think on the dialogue, the way I came at that same kind of experience, I think, was that there's people say things, but they don't have conversations. Like, they talk at each other. They just sort of say things to each other. And I was struck because for the Foundation show we did, I was like trying to compare, especially the adaptation version. I was like, how is this not working? I was like, okay, let me go watch the first few episodes of Game of Thrones because that worked. And I don't remember why, and I just liked it. It's relationship. It's relation. Mm-hmm. So much of it is relationship building, and people have conversations where they learn, and there's tension, and there's like little story arcs even between little scenes with just two people talking. Foundation certainly doesn't do that, and I think Dune doesn't really do that. Like, what are the relationships between the people that matter? Jen, are you on the same wavelength here?
I so disagree with
okay,
you.
Okay, go.
And
let's
it's
go.
Funny because it's now been what, a year and a half, 2 years since I reread it. So I like, and I couldn't find my copy. I like, I looked for it because I wanted to check the page count for where the movie got to versus where the book did, and then my copy was gone, so I couldn't. I was like, shoot. So, but my overwhelming feeling of having read Dune at least twice now, if not maybe one or two more times, is that the characters, I know exactly how they're all connected and why they care about each other and what their relationships are and who's got a fraught relationship with who and, you know, why that is. And I absolutely feel like those character relationships are there and important to me now because it's been a minute. And but it's funny to me, I don't have a memory of rereading it and being like, wow, he's a bad writer. Like, I don't remember feeling that way, and I don't remember thinking, boy, he's a great writer. Like, I don't remember that either, but whatever it was, I guess it worked enough for me that my feeling of having read it is, yeah, I know why Jessica had a boy instead of a girl like she was supposed to. I know why there's this complicated relationship between Hawat and Jessica. I know what Leto and Jessica's marriage is like. I know what Paul feels about everybody around him. Like, I know those things. So clearly the book must have told me because the movie sure didn't.
Nope.
Maybe to split the needle there, I think there's maybe we could be saying the same thing in different ways, which is maybe Amanda and I responding to the actual dialogue, like parentheses dialogue is pretty sparse, but there's a lot of internal dialogue. There's a lot of thinking that happens in people's heads where you
like
do get the richness, like maybe more. Yeah, even more than that. I think also becomes difficult to translate onto the screen because if you're not doing voiceovers, internal discourse is very difficult to represent in a way there. So I think that one of the aridnesses that comes, emotional aridness of the movie, I think, is because you don't get the richness that's not coming through in the lines that people say, which are pretty bare. But I agree with you, Jen. I do think the relationships are interesting. They just are everyone thinking about each other is how we get those relationships
that's mostly fair.
Put together as well. So what's the best thing about the book? Like, is it the world building? Is it the complexity? Like, What do people for? What people are for Dune? What are they for?
Admittedly, I was young, so you know, whatever. But when I read it, the thing that I liked about it the most, and I think that stands up upon my reread, is that it's so he's juggling so many plates that it's like a feat. It's a fascinating thing to watch an author do. Like, this is why I say he's a very good plotter. He's not a great dialogue mm-hmm. writer, but he's such a good plotter. And everybody's playing such a long game that he somehow is keeping track of for not just an entire novel, but for 20 novels, you know, and it continues. Oh, yeah. All of these threads continue on and on and on forever. And that's just like, that brain is fascinating to me. And it's like singular. I mean, we've got Game of Thrones, but it's not finished, you know, and we've got we have a lot of big, epic, complicated universes in pop culture now, but I don't think there's anything that's so destiny, that's like so tied to the idea of destiny and fate and things being foretold, which means that the author had to foretell them from page one, and right. we're on like page 5,000, and that is—it's amazing. It's an amazing feat, and that's the thing that I think that makes it singular. That's the best thing about it.
Epic is almost too small to think about when we think about epic, because this is galactic and millennia spanning, mm-hmm. and you know, we start in the middle, and because we get these weird paratextual introductions to chapters that are written from the future. Right. So the whole thing is like a text, like it's a sacred text of a kind, yes. or a historical yes. document of some kind, which makes you feel that it's even bigger. Like, this is just one, and all these other subtexts and other readings that go on to it. There's things that happened way in the past before this. The Bene Gesserit have been around for thousands of years, and they're playing in a 1,000-year game to try to get mm-hmm. this, you know, one being created. So it doesn't even have like... I always thought that the Lord of the Rings had the deepest world building I'd ever experienced, because like there's the second age and the third age, and this that would be like one pocket of the Dune-iverse, right? That's just like one little piece of it, Middle Earth, in that way. And I think when you say plate spinning, the way I reacted, in a way, the book's biggest topic is complexity, of how complex mm-hmm. things are. Because Lord of the Rings, you got to get rid of the ring. Star Wars, we got to get rid of Darth Vader and the Emperor. Game of Thrones, even, who's going to sit on the throne? What's the one sentence plot of Dune? I mean, Jen, like, what is the? I mean, what is the stakes? What do we care about in Dune? Because I think that's something that you are alluding to a little bit when you talk about the relationships. Is it's the mess, right? Is it the mess? Or like, what do we care about what do we care about if we care about what's going on in Dune?
Well, yeah, and I think this is where often when you try to simplify, you lose that complexity, because like at the highest level, it's like, you know, coming of age story, you know, foretold, powerful child born with weird powers has to come into his own, into his destiny. But like that totally erases the fact mm-hmm. that like Paul is constantly trying to figure out how to have any agency within the magnificently long-term, like Amanda said, machinations of everyone around him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that destiny is not a good thing. He knows from the jump people are going to die, and he doesn't feel great about it. Like, this is not a noble quest. This is a quest for power, to try to be the least amount of evil, not mm-hmm. the most right. And I think also something that really got lost for me in the movie, and that as was so important to me as a teenager reading this, probably because I also was swimming in these waters of environmentalism, is the relationship between the Fremen and Arrakis. Like, they have talk about a long game. They are working on a generations long terraforming project in secret. It's amazing. Yeah. Like, that it's just as long of a game as the Bene Gesserit are playing, or, you know, the Imperial House is playing. Like, they're playing their own long game, and seeing how all of those games like bounce off of each other and interact, and then the mess of it, like you said, is what's so interesting about that book.
I would be remiss to, and you touched on it, and it's one of those things that's almost too obvious if you have any experience with Dune to say, but we might as well say it out loud as people are experiencing for the first time. The setting's unbelievable. Like, you talked mm-hmm. about the Fremen's relation with Arrakis, but like, I don't know what to say. Desert planet with giant worms is cool. Still suits are cool. Chris knives are cool. Like, I think that my 13-year-old self was really cool. was mostly reacting to, wow, is this cool? Look at the way they, you know, they basically like dehydrate each other like raisins when they die, and take each other's water and all. There's like a very organic culture building. Sometimes we mistake world building and culture building when we talk about these things. And I think culture building is maybe more powerful than world building, or at least that's what we talk about when we talk about world building. Does it feel like this is how people might actually respond in the environment in which we find them. And that really feels inevitable almost in a way that is probably not, but it's very seductive in its own way. Go ahead, Jeff.
And I think we have to say at this point, we probably should have said it sooner, that that culture building is so heavily influenced by Islam and other North African cultures and also native cultures in the United States. So, you know, Herbert was borrowing wholesale in some cases from indigenous cultures and weaving those elements. I mean, you can't have the story without Islam. Like, you just can't. It doesn't, the book doesn't exist without that influence, for example.
And linguistically, it's so obvious. Like, he's not trying to hide it, right? Because, like, he's using these, some of it are actual Arabic terms, some of them are kind of distorted or otherwise, but it's the text is the subtext here. In a lot of ways, the very simple, might be more accurate culture reading, this is like the story of Western colonialism in the Middle East, is trying to grapple with that in some ways, in some ways that don't hold up as well, but in a fundamental way, trying to take it seriously and upend, and with the tools that he has, I should say, conventional narratives about how those things go. Even something like Lawrence of Arabia, which came out, you know, right as Herbert's writing Dune. Right. Mm. And to the point where he has to rewrite a bunch of it because it's like, well, this is too close to what Lawrence of Arabia is doing. And Lawrence of Arabia is its own. It's more complicated of that now. Right. Eventually, Lawrence of Arabia tried to, you know, basically he was charged by the British with helping the Turks try to beat the Ottoman Empire for their goals, but also for the British Empire's goals. When the war is over, Lawrence of Arabia advocates for Arab self-determination and fails, right? So that's in the water of what's going on too now, still centering white people and the way that the movie and certainly the casting. And I think the book still does. I read it with this lens. Like, it's interesting some of the other allusions that are in the book, right? This is the House of Atreides. For those of you who are Greek mythology myths, the House of Atreides is its own thing. You know, the Atreides are the brothers Menelaus and Agamemnon, Agamemnon being the leader of the Greek army in the Trojan War. Menelaus, his wife Helen absconds, is stolen, various readings, by Paris, which initiates the Trojan War. Let's just say that things don't go great for the Atreides brothers, but it's Greek, right? And Greek mythology has an interesting place in how we understand West versus East. Are they white? Are they Westerners? It's very complicated. And then the movie does some weird stuff about bullfighting and bagpipes, which I think is bringing it's bringing it further towards, you know, like white Europe, and decomplicating some of the other things there. And the Harkonnens are clearly some sort of Nordic, you know, exaggeration, stereotype, whatever that's going on there. But he's remixing to various levels of success various real world Middle Eastern, Eastern, Western tensions, I think is probably the best way to put it generously. Doesn't always go super well. And reading that again, I was super worried about this, honestly. I was really worried. Like, is this going to be a racist mess? And my sense is that it's not. Like, it's definitely flawed. But I didn't have a lot of cringe moments necessarily. Then now we can get to some of them. We're actually on the actual bad guy side, I think, or maybe the worst in terms of fat phobia and homophobia and stuff. But Amanda, did your shoulders raise that much, or how were you feeling about it as reading it as a modern reader with all of our pseudo modern sensibilities?
I mean, there were in the less good things part, I have some stuff that
I'm kind of transitioning there. Did you see that?
Okay.
You
know, well, I didn't know if you wanted me to talk about it specifically.
Fine. Whatever you'd like to do, whatever you'd like to do. Yeah.
I think I had the same experience with the racial elements that you did, where I was like, this would probably not play well if it were written today, but I'm not like mad at it, or, you know, like, it's obviously not without flaws, but I'm not gonna throw the thing in the garbage like I have literally done with other, you know, classic sci-fi novels where I'm like, I can't deal with this anymore. Like, I just it's awful. I did not put it in the trash. But another reason, I mean, I think a bigger reason that this book would probably not be written today is the gender issues.
Yeah.
Like, this is an entire novel about the search for a non-binary person. We've got those. Right. We're good. Like, this is fine. You know, if somebody presented this novel to a publisher in 2021, I feel like the editor would be like, but this is not actually a problem. Like, you could just go next door probably, and because these people are alive. I don't understand what this is about, you know. And so when I finished my reread, I actually texted Jen. It was like, Jen, this is just a book about a non-binary person. She was like, yes, correct. And I was like, okay, great.
Yeah.
And you, like you mentioned, the fat phobia is awful. And in the book,
it's so
bad. Like, I really wanted the movie to do something with that, because I think that's the most the most egregious just nonsense part of the novel, but they didn't, and so I have a lot to say about that. But the fat phobia in the book, in the movie, it's the only signal that the Harkonnens are bad. In the book, we have actual reasons why the Harkonnens are bad. Like, you're given actual moral, ethical character reasons, but not many. like not enough to make up for it. Just that they just never stop talking about it.
Yeah,
he's always being compared to the Harkonnen, the Baron, who is this character who's supposed to be like grossly overweight, quote quote. You know, he's always being compared to the physicality of people around him, and it's just ugh. That made me cringe. Lots and lots and lots.
It does make me, you know, one of the things that's moved on, I think those discussions and representations are, you know, those things age the worst, right? They mm-hmm. definitely age the worst. But I think also the construction of a modern, quote unquote, good villain are way different, like of mm-hmm. what we expect from a villain. Or even if there is a villain, as Jen was alluding to earlier, of like the complexity, the situation, the power dynamics, the, you know, people have different relationships with power dynamics, but like what we want from the quote unquote bad guy is way different. Even so, looking at someone like very, like the biggest pop culture one you can think of right now, like Thanos, right? Is about 10,000 times more interesting than Baron Harkonnen, honestly. Yeah. Like, it's clearly a bad guy. He's an evil guy, but it's like got an idea that's not just, I want to get my kid on the throne. Like, that's so, it doesn't feel like interesting at all. Like Darth Vader, classic one. You know, the one for me as a kid, I was like, whoa, there are things that I understand about Darth Vader. He's alone yeah. and he wants his son and all that stuff. The Harkonnens have none of that. Now, maybe in books 11 through 5,000, some of that other stuff happens. Right. But like, no, there might as well be like a cardboard cutout of like bad guy stereotypes. Like they're ugly yeah. and they're fat and they don't have any hair and they've got all these weapons and they say these weird things and they want things that are clearly bad and selfish and wrong.
And they're gay. Let's not forget. In the book, he is coded as, well, not even just coded
no,
as.
No, like, bring me cool. the boy,
we're
right?
Told it's like that stuff he's like gay. That. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's bad. Bad,
that,
bad,
mercifully,
bad.
The movie left out, even if it didn't yeah. leave out everything. That part, I was like, are they at least aware enough to leave that part out? And maybe that was intentional or not, but that part was not in the movie to this point. There's a really good The White Savior narrative in Slate. We'll put mm-hmm. in the show notes there as well. Let's do most memorable bits. I mean, the sandworms, right? The sandworms are amazing. Like the whole thing.
Wait, of the book or the movie? What are we?
Let's do the book for just a minute, okay. Right? Like the whole.
Yes.
The whole sort of like the trade craft of worms is so fun. Like, yeah. It's like how do you get around
how do you
on
write
them?
It?
How do you avoid
yeah.
them? Like
yeah.
Like so fascinating. I thought that detail stuff is so amazing. So that was my number one draft pick for what really stuck out to me as fun and interesting. Jen, how about you? What really sticks out to you as a highlight of the book?
As a kid, I was obsessed with the stillsuits. I wanted a stillsuit.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the most amazing idea in the world, and I think that's incredible. And when I was rereading it a couple years ago, I got really into Alia, the sister,
yes.
and the just that whole concept of like this child who's been changed in the womb and is now this preternaturally, I don't even know what word to use here.
Conscious.
Yeah, that's probably the right word. Like, I was just like, oh, like that. I feel like a lot of people do, you know, children who are mature or smart or whatever mm-hmm. before their times, but the lengths to which Alia is portrayed, but also the fact that she gets to have a character that's not just I am this like incredibly conscious human, like she gets to be other things.
Yeah,
I actually really loved upon the reread.
It's like if the three-eyed raven, Brandon Stark, like mm-hmm. wanted things, you get
yes.
Alia.
Yeah.
That actually
yeah.
had a little bit of like, I know all, I remember everything and I see all this stuff, but also I want my mother to survive. You know,
and,
that kind of
and
stuff.
Favorite scene, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I
That's
can't
fine.
Not say, my favorite scene is the dinner scene on Arrakis, mm-hmm. where we really get to see Kynes interacting with Leto and all of these like, under the radar thing, there's so much subtext and people are like poking at each other in these really subtle ways and there's so much wheeling and dealing going on and establishing who's in allied with who and what's plotting and all of whose goals are being advanced or not advanced. Like, it's so good. I love that dinner
sequence. You know, of the memorable scenes, I think for me that's the one that sticks out in a second read. Like, I think as a mm-hmm. kid I probably wouldn't have been
oh,
as excited
yeah, no.
about I much more right. want like the Jameis Paul like like duel, yes, and that kind of stuff, which again is pretty cool. But yeah, that one with Stilgar, especially in all these like shadow kind of messages that people aren't picking up and are picking up, for sure. Amanda, how about you? What sticks out as highlights?
The Bene Gesserit. I was obsessed with the Bene Gesserit from the jump. And now that the book that I just finished before I reread this was Lauren Groff's new book, Matrix, which is about like a community of nuns in the 12th century that seclude themselves from men and build this whole like self-functioning community. So I'm very like nuns on the brain right now. And going from that to the Bene Gesserit, I'm like, oh, this is like what the world would look like if Lauren Groff's women ruled it.
Yes, like, so Illuminati space nuns. I'm all in for Illuminati space nuns.
It's amazing. And like they can control you, but they kind of don't care to, but they kind of absolutely do. And like they're not on the throne, but they control the throne. And it has a bit too much of the like behind every man is a strong woman crap, which I don't love. But they're not even behind. Like they're just in front of you, making you do what you don't want to do because they planned it 4,000 years ago. Whoops, sorry. Right. Like, that's just, it's fascinating to me. Also, the hand signal thing. So, like, in thinking about the dinner scene, they have whole conversations, not just the Atreides with each other, but also with their staff using hand signals. And it's a little bit in the movie, but it's like, it's not just instructions or one word. They're having, like, sentence-long, paragraph-long combos with each other that no one else is noticing? Like, is no one else noticing that? How do you do that? How do you have such
an intricate... sign language influence.
Right. Yeah. How do you have such an intricate sign language with one hand under a table that no one notices? I just have a lot of questions about that.
I didn't catch it. I caught that on the reread of like, oh, they're using hand signals. But that was one thing where the movie actually did something for me. It's like, oh, that's really useful, actually. Yeah. You know, like I didn't, in the book, it's the spatial arrangement. It's harder to track. But like, oh yeah, if you're sitting to the side of someone or your hand's behind a chair and someone can see you, you could have this whole other conversation, which is a nice representation of sign language that it's like there are strengths, right? It's not just, you know, a simple like, well, this is what you do when you can't talk and too bad for you guys. No. Like there's a very, very robust, communication system at play.
I wonder, now I have to go looking to see if somebody from the deaf community has written about the use of hand signals in the book or the movie. I would love to read that piece. Mm-hmm. I will have to do some research. We'll put it in the show notes if I can find one.
Yeah, and if anyone's seen one.
There's an Adaptation Nation email.
Oh, hit me with it then. I should have made one.
It's adaptationnation@bookriot.com.
Boy, that would have been hard for me to guess in the moment. Other things in terms of the actual book reading experience that are bummers, downers, mistakes, problems, tough hangs, you know, whatever else we want to call them.
I had a problem with Jessica and Leto's relationship. Like the fact that he would not marry her because he needed to be available for political scheming. Like he needed the other houses to consider that he was available, even though very obviously everyone else knows that he was not available. Like, you're not hiding for such sophisticated schemers. The fact that they thought they were hiding, that they were like deeply in love and were never going to touch anyone else ever for the rest of time was like, come on.
Like, okay. Oh, so you're saying like, how is this working on anybody? Like you get like, okay. I see what
because
you're saying.
Because anyone who wanted to marry the Duke for political reasons would have wanted a child from that. And that's not going to happen because he's so deeply in love with this woman. Like, and also, would anybody want to get on the bad side of a Bene Gesserit warrior princess? Probably
that part I wasn't exactly sure about either. So, like, that's like kind of anyone you get married as a man in a noble house, you have a Bene Gesserit concubine is sort of a thing that people just do, and then you marry someone else in the Landsrad. And I was like, boy, you really are going to that with your eyes closed.
Right.
if that's what we're just sort of agreeing.
Good luck.
I guess it's kind of a plot hole or. I don't know. That doesn't really play out. I didn't really have too much, to be honest with you. I think I just want more from bad guys now, other than I want revenge. I thought the plot to kill Harkonnen by the doctor was actually kind of cool and surprising. You know, I think that's another thing we've come a little bit accustomed to later, where someone you think is the main character dies in the first half. Spoiler alert, should have been at the beginning. But in hindsight, it was really interesting, that scene where there's in the tooth and you can understand his motives and he's not right and he's not wrong and he's bad and he's good, and how naive Leto is. And it kind of works, right? There's a very Ned Starkian quality to the good Baron himself. It's all Game of Thrones reference. I've been into it for the last couple weeks, so I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Amanda.
No, I was just going to say it's that uber, that like overly simplistic, honorable ding dong of a character. Yeah. Like, you're so sweet. And I love that. I love all of your feelings, but you're a little dumb.
Is Duke Leto a himbo?
I'm not conversing in these terms enough. I'm going to have to edit that. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, that's a good question for those of you who know what that is. Yeah,
I think the answer is yes. I think it is.
The other thing that struck me, again, I don't remember the time, is the idea that as you peel back the layers of the Fremen, like, they're definitely colonized, but they're not subject in a way that we understand it. Like, they've got their own networks, they've got their own plans. Like, they would prefer, of course, not to have the Harkonnens or Atreides there, but they're working on their own plans. They don't really need a savior in the way that, you know, if they play the long enough game, I guess. If they play a long enough game and they terraform the world and Spice kind of goes away or they can control it, which they already kind of are by paying off the guild. Like, that part was pretty cool as well. That representation of the subject people was more interesting than even movies you see today that are about this. Mm-hmm. Like, even something like, I don't know, Hunger Games and the different things. Like, all these people are so downtrodden that they're basically rolling around in rags and have no agency at all. And that's not the Fremen at all. And that's part of the plot. No. But I thought something that a lot of representations of oppression could learn from is that it's not as simple as liberated or subject. Like, there's a bunch of experiences and vibrancies that exist between those two poles. So that was, I thought that was warmly welcomed.
I think that actually reminds me of a thing I had trouble with in the book and then subsequently in all the adaptations, which is that, you know, there's this idea that the Bene Gesserit have seeded these prophecies throughout the galaxy over the years to, like, pave the way for their own goals and missions. And I think this was maybe in that the Slate piece we referenced earlier that we're going to link to, but this idea that it takes an outside person to come and save your culture. It's like, are we buying that? Like, are we really buying that? Like, I don't know. Like, that part, I was just like, oh, yeah, like, if it has to be an off world, do you know what I mean? Somebody's coming from outside of the system to save us. Like, I just am like, most of the prophecies that have shown up in the religions that I've studied are about people from inside the community for obvious reasons. Yeah. So, like, the idea that, like, a people would be so susceptible to being told that, like, it's going to take an outside person to come and save them is, like, it's suspect. I think that's like, Western, you know, Orientalism, et cetera, exceptionalism at work there.
Yeah, I see. I definitely agree with that. I think, for me, the interesting that it's two-sided, right? There's a critique of religion in the idea that it can be manipulated too, right?
Yes.
Like, if you just these are
Which
also
I'm,
political
I'm
systems.
For.
Yeah, me
I'm
too. Yeah,
that.
It's very complicated, but that is an interesting way of looking. But the seduction of a messiah, I think, you know, we're living in that world of the superhero ourselves, right? This idea if only one person were sufficiently smart or clever or infused with gamma rays, this could all be better. When the reality is, you know, and this goes right back to Fanon, it's like community led, identity centric. Yeah. Internal, he was really like, they need guns, but let's put it that to the side for just a second. Like, the best and most enduring revolutions happen because the people who need the liberation do it themselves and they build it for their own aims. And this, and I think that's also the subtext, like, this is an exploiting move by the Bene Gesserit, right? And it's not going to work. And Paul sees what the ramifications are. So the arrogance of thinking that you can manipulate a whole people through religion and then control it after the fact is like the high, hubris to the nth degree. Anything else about the book before we move on to the most recent adaptation?
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by K.T. Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Louise can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden, and thanks again to W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
All right, let's do it then. The movie. I have a whole section for what it is and how did it come to be. This is more interesting if it's been out for a while. I think this is pretty straightforward, right? Like, people are looking for the next Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Marvel Cinematic Universe. Villeneuve makes very beautiful science fiction worlds. Chalamet and Zendaya are big stars. And this is one of the top five existing IP franchises that do not have an ongoing lucrative franchise, right? It's like kind of an arranged marriage. Like, I'm not sure it's one of the heart, but it's one of the cash register. Is there anything I'm missing in that formulation, Jen?
I do think it is worth noting all of the confusion around what this movie was, in that they really buried that it was only part one until right before it came out. Like, that was not news that we knew for a good minute there. And then they had not greenlit a second one, which is fascinating. I do look forward to the investigative, you know, pop culture journalism that happens around finding out exactly, like, was it just they were like, we need to see the box office receipts before we give you the money? Or was there something else going on there? I don't know. But I think it's a really weird choice, because now we have to wait until 2023, because it wasn't greenlit. They couldn't film it at the same time, which is what everybody else does when they're breaking a movie into parts. You film it all at the same freaking time. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened here. So I actually am super curious, once it's been out for longer and you know, maybe lips are a little looser, we find out some more insider info about what was involved in that decision making.
Yeah. Amanda, a lot of people have said, especially since the Lynchian, whatever you want to call that, you know, it's now had a couple of swings where it was so bad and a bomb, and then it has sort of apparently a cult following of some kind. I cannot see it. I think I find the movie completely unwatchable. That's me. And then Dune got the reputation of being unfilmable, which to me now, I guess I could understand that in 1990. Does this feel like an unfilmable book to you, Amanda?
Well, like, that's kind of an interesting way of asking if this adaptation was any good.
Yeah, how about that?
Well done, I see you. Yes, I think it is unfilmable and continues to be, which is not to say this is a bad movie. Right. And I enjoyed watching it, and I think that I'm excited for part two, and I will watch part two, and that will be great, I'm sure. But is it... like, is it the Lord of the Rings kind of adaptation, where Lord of the Rings was such a great book to screen situation? Mm-hmm. No. Like, as so much of the book is left completely unexplained in a way that makes a viewer who has never read Dune lost at sea, like, pretty lost at sea. So this has been the thing that I've heard most from my friends who have not read the book, who watched the movie, is that they liked it, and it was pretty, and it was fun, but they had no idea what was going on most of the time.
Yeah, but, like, literally what's going on.
Yeah, but, like, the word Mentat is never said. Why does that guy's... Yep. Why do his eyes blink that way? Like, what... why, what is the way? Everyone talks about, like, they describe the way as the thing they're doing with their voice, but also the thing that they've done on Arrakis to prepare a way. Like, nothing makes sense. None of the mythology is explained. And I think that it's unadaptable because of what we were saying about the dialogue, where so much of the plot is revealed through what people are thinking as they're in conversation with each other. And unless you completely change how people communicate, you can't make that, or at least no one has yet made that into a movie that is both good to watch and also true to the source material.
So it's go ahead, Jen.
I think it is adaptable. I think you just have to do it as prestige TV. It's so clear to me, at least, that book one could be done as a semi-limited series. Like, take as many episodes as you need. Have, you know, the Imperial Princess doing voiceover or whatever. I think there's ways to do it. I think we've seen people do similar things with other properties that are very dense. I think it's going to be interesting to see what Wheel of Time does, because there's a whole deep amount of world building in that they're going to have to reckon with to make it intelligible. And I think there are ways to do it. I don't think you can do it shot for shot, dialogue for dialogue, scene for scene, which is what I think this movie tried to do, and part of the reason it failed for me. But I think that you could do it. I do think you could do it.
Yeah, I think historically the unfilmable bits was, how do you shoot giant sandworms? That doesn't look ridiculous.
We've solved that problem.
We have solved that problem. And, you know, and the sandworms are, I don't know what else you want from a giant sandworm in the movie, right? It looks amazing. And I like that point you made, Jen. Like, you need to get the essence of the movie, you would need to change it, or the book, you would need to change it for the screen, because for the exact same reasons Amanda and I were saying, it's unfilmable. As written, it's unfilmable to do it as it is. So you need to make some of the internal stuff explicit somehow, whether that you make it some dialogue, maybe you do voiceover. But I agree with you. That's my note at the end, is like, what the thing would you change? And I said, I would change the format. I would flop Foundation and Dune. I would make Foundation 1 3-hour movie with these vignettes that actually do what's, you know, in the book. hot take. And then make this a ongoing Game of Thrones-like series. And maybe, you know, I don't know, does it end in the same place? I don't know. You get to spend a lot more time with it. You know, Game of Thrones season 1 is 8 to 10 hours, I guess, of film. And this is 2 hours and 20 minutes for half the book. So even if you get two pieces, that's still half as many minutes you're spending with one really long book. And
I mean, all you have to do is cut out all the scenes of Zendaya looking over her shoulder dreamily, and you've got another 30 minutes solid.
But then she's not in the movie, which is such we'll get into that
later.
Well,
let's take that, because we didn't dwell too much on, Jen, what you were talking about. Sort of, they seem to feel like they were in some sort of marketing handcuffs about how to portray what this movie is. That's Dune Part 1. And I was even surprised to see, and I assume you guys saw it too, I think Jen, you saw it at drive-in, and Amanda, you saw it at home like I did, that when the title card comes up, it says Dune and then Part 1 right under it.
I didn't even notice, to be perfectly honest.
Which was the first time I'd seen that, right? It wasn't on any of the marketing materials, and it wasn't communicated at all. Now, most people, Jen and I had some furious DMs about, what is this movie? Like, are they doing the whole thing? And you found an interview with Villeneuve that was like, more than strongly hinting that it was not the whole book, and that they were going to do the second part, which maybe there was a nod, wink, wink, knowing, look agreement between Warner Brothers and Villeneuve. But that was really weird, because if you didn't, I guess the Part 1 lets you off the hook a little bit for the end of this movie, which is a very much like Fellowship of the Rings, and now we're going to walk together into the future. Without Part 1, people think that's the end of the movie and they're mad, right? I think they're really mad. So they have to do a little bit both, but they also didn't want to tell us from the beginning it was Part 1 because they didn't agree to do it, which is very strange. So I hadn't thought about the New Yorker or Vulture long article, oral history of why that's Dune Part 1, not filmed at the same time. I hadn't thought about that, but I am looking forward to the TikTok of how that gets made as well. Let's talk about casting for a minute as we talk about Zendaya. You know, I am not surprised. I don't know if I would have done anything differently given the constraints they set for themselves. Like, how do you bring, you can't bring her in earlier, right? And to have her in the book more in the present tense, you even go further into the book. I think they were trying to have their cake and eat it too with all of those long lingering shots of looking over your shoulder at Zendaya with her, the sunset in the background. Like, yeah, she's in the movie, and so we're not lying to you, but she's in like 7 minutes of the movie and has like maybe 10 lines of dialogue. At the end,
most of it is exposition.
Right.
And yeah. not anything about her character, who she is, what she wants, what she's doing there.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing. Which the book also doesn't do, frankly, until much later.
Well, yeah.
Into the book as well. Other thoughts about casting?
But you can fix these things if you decide to.
Right. Amanda, let's talk about cast. I mean, everyone, Zendaya and Chalamet are probably your number one and two or 1A and 1B draft picks for young Hollywood stars, right? I mean, I'm not sure. It's almost so obvious. That's one of my notes about the casting. Like, all the casting felt super obvious to me.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts about the casting, Amanda?
I cannot deal with Timothée Chalamet. I don't understand the cultural obsession with him right now. It weirds me out that he looks like a middle schooler and all of my like lady friends who are almost 40 are like deeply into him, and it freaks me. I don't get it. He's like this tiny little, I don't understand. Anyway, he had no face. He makes no facial expression. I got like 30 minutes into this movie and I remember turning to Bob, who I was watching it with, and was like, does he move his face? Has he moved his face? Like any part of his face? Has it moved? And the answer was no. He didn't make, literally did not make a facial expression until he had a breakdown in the tent after his father died. That's it. And that is halfway through the film. So that was gross. My favorite casting was, I don't even know her name, but the actress who played Keynes was fantastic.
She was great. I should look that up. I should have had the cast list.
I have it here.
Right. Okay, Jen.
What's her name?
Yep,
she was my favorite.
Her name is Sharon Duncan Brewster. Yeah, and she was one of the casting choices I was the most excited about when I found out they were gender bending Liet Kynes, because he's a dude in the book, and I was like, oh, this is so juicy and interesting. She didn't get to do enough, but she was great.
She was great.
I actually also really liked Javier Bardem as Stilgar. He brought this just stern sand daddy energy to that character. Like, he just was mad. Like, he just was irritated at everyone, didn't want to be anywhere that he was at that moment ever. And it was almost comic relief, which is not intentional. That character's not supposed to be funny, but I think he did it on purpose a little bit. It lightened it up a little. It humanized the Fremen in a way that the movie had done zero of up until that moment, up until Javier Bardem came in and spat at Leto. And you're like, oh, no, wait, that's a good thing. You know, I think he was great. That was a surprise. Like,
Bardem is amazing. Can I just dwell for a minute on Bardem for a second? Yeah. Because people sometimes just bring who they are with them, or like they bring their character energy. And Bardem is so good on camera as a menacing figure, but you can't help but really find charming, right? Like, he's one of the great bad guys in No Country for Old Men, one of the more charismatic of all Bond villains in whichever Bond movie. Is that Spectre or Skyfall? I can never remember. I can't keep that.
I think it's Skyfall.
Skyfall. And here, I think the casting is playing with our preconceived notion of Bardem, is like, this is a bad guy that you want to like, so you're liking him doesn't conform nor deny that he's a bad guy, probably in fact affirms it, but he has a turn, you know, a little bit later, and it's not quite so simple as those things go. But I agree, he was my favorite. Whenever he was off screen, I wanted him on screen, which is always the way I test if I like what the casting is doing. Jen, how about you for casting thoughts?
Well, I agree in theory about Bardem that he's an amazing actor who does the thing he's been given to do very well. I cannot get over my discomfort with the way they cast the Fremen.
Yeah.
There's been tons of discussion about how they did not cast any Middle Eastern or North African actors for speaking roles, or hardly any roles at all in this movie, which is a huge oversight and issue given the influences, which they also downplayed in a way that I find very weird. And that a lot of other folks have written very intelligent things about that we will link to in the show notes. But like, if you, because they're basically kind of saying all brown people are just brown. Like, everybody's just brown, which is weird and incorrect and sort of, I don't know. I can't get over that part of that casting. So I wish he had been cast as somebody else. But I do agree that he's excellent.
You know, we have these terms that makes, can I just dwell on that for a minute? It makes me wonder about, you know, we have words for like first wave, second wave, third wave feminism. I feel like we have different waves of representation understanding.
Sure.
And this feels like a first wave representation understanding across the board, which is it's better than it would have been in 92 or certainly 84 to take the real bad example, but it's not, it doesn't represent the best of our current understanding of how to make these things, you know, useful and true and responsible. I don't know if it's first or second wave probably second wave, because first wave representation is nothing. It's just white people all the way down. This is, we can do some gender bending, we can do some race bending, but let's actually think about like the actual political specificity of casting a particular people in a particular way. That's interesting. Other highlights, lowlights for casting for you, Jen?
I have to agree about Chalamet. I hated him as Paul. I was like, he's just a sullen teenager for the entire movie, which is part of what Paul is, but not all of what Paul is. And also, in order for us to care about him, I think you need more from that character on the screen. And you just don't get it. I will say I was pleasantly surprised by Jason Momoa. When that casting decision was announced, I was super not on board. I was like, That's just a no from me. I love him, but in that role, I was like, no, it just doesn't make any sense to me. But he was way better than I was expecting him to be as Duncan Idaho.
Jen. Why were you so nervous about Momoa?
Well, he is not... Okay, in my defense...
He plays Jason Momoa. Is that where
I had
going?
Well, that, but I also had just seen Aquaman, which I am not a fan of.
Tough hang, Aquaman.
Oh, it was so rough. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, man, like, is he going to bring, like, are we getting Aquaman as Duncan Idaho? Like, I'm super not here for that.
Show title.
That's not what I want on my screen. But that's not what he did, in his defense. So, I retract my objections. He was fine. I think Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto was like exactly what he should have been in the minimalist character development that everybody got. Mm-hmm. I was just really bummed that I didn't get to see more from, you know, like Chang Chen as Wellington Yue, or from Zendaya as Chani, or from who played Thufir Hawat? Stephen McKinley Henderson. Like, there were so many interesting casting choices, and I just didn't get to see them do anything. Which
That's
was a
really good way of articulating something I couldn't quite articulate myself, which I thought Chalamet was fine. Actually, he gave me appreciation for Mark Hamill in Star Wars, which I've never been the biggest Mark Hamill fan. But like, Paul is 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this movie, 15-year-olds are dummies. 15-year-olds have weird energy, and he's just standing around with bedroom eyes and a sallow demeanor. Like, I just didn't feel like there was much going on there. At least Hamill feels like a teenager. Like, I don't love his performance in Star Wars on the whole. It's fine. But, you know, Han and Leia are the best pieces there. Where Chalamet's like, boy, I'm really not getting much except bedroom eyes looking into the distance and, like, having weird visions about Zendaya. I just didn't get too much. But I think something you just said made me think about my biggest feeling about the movie writ large is it radiates out from the casting is it feels like a missed opportunity. Because there's so many places I wanted to spend more time. I wasn't waiting for the movie to be over. I was like, wait, stay here for a minute, stay here for a minute. And that suggests to me the casting was good. I do think the casting was Momoa's Duncan Idaho. I felt, at first I was excited because like Momoa's fun, but you don't want a whole movie around him, which I think is the Aquaman problem. It's like he does a particular thing, but he's not all the crayons in the box. But he brought a warmth and like humanity to the movie, like smiled, like like hit someone in the shoulder. And that you really need, and like, oh, more of that, more of that. And I was like, the only one I didn't like, and I put my notes here, I thought Brolin was a mistake. It didn't give me anything.
Yeah.
Gurney Halleck is this warrior, poet, musician kind of figure.
Mm-hmm. He didn't sing.
What? I'm sorry, say again?
He didn't sing. Brolin didn't sing.
He get one little like Rebecca Ferguson or someone throws in the mic, say, you probably have a scripture of that. And he like says it under his breath while he's eating space porridge or whatever.
Right. Exactly.
I wanted something else. I don't know what I wanted there. My only other thought was I kind of was looking for like maybe a Viggo in Lord of the Rings vibe, kind of the reluctant, thoughtful. Mm-hmm. Viggo sings in that, but he's also a warrior and has a different kind of vibe. Like, I don't know what direction Villeneuve gave Brolin, but he got like Full Metal Jacket vibes out of him. Like, it didn't do anything. I thought that was really tough because you could have done so much more with that. But that was my only one that I was like, that really was a mistake. You know, Isaac, pretty to look at, nice beard, you know, good stuff out of Isaac, playing upon his innate affection for Oscar Isaac, I think, here, because he doesn't get to do much, so we need to care that he dies, and he gets 45 minutes to care about him. So, like, okay, let's get someone people know already. Anything else there? Okay, so we haven't talked about, is this a good adaptation? I think we're kind of on a spectrum. Jen, did you enjoy this?
I enjoyed the visuals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did not enjoy the movie, okay, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I felt like it really, I mean, I said like minimalist earlier, which is a funny thing to say about a movie that was so dramatic. But I do think the visuals were pretty stark, and certainly the character development was minimalist. But I felt like there were so many times when they tried to take these shortcuts in the place of actually developing anything. Like, so Amanda, you were saying earlier about like how the only reason we know that Baron Harkonnen is bad is because he's fat. Mm-hmm. And I was like, actually, the thing I kept thinking was that they could not have overdone Harkonnens are bad, yeah, like visually, if they had tried, like they got the darkest lighting. Everything was black in the background. There was no sun ever anywhere the Harkonnens were. They wore all black. Baron Harkonnen emerges from a pool of like, who knows what oil?
Yeah.
Like
oily man, he's like, man grease. Yeah. Like, what is that? I don't even
what
know.
What is that? And
stuff.
He like he just. I mean, it's so like even like you could have removed the fat suit. You should have removed the fat mm-hmm. suit, mm-hmm. and like you would have been. He's like Dr. Evil. He is the Dune version of Dr. Evil. Like none of them actually talk in a normal tone of voice ever. They're either like creepily whispering or screaming. Like it's just so. So over the top. Like, I'm like, I get it. They're bad. You want us to think they're bad. Okay, they're bad. Yeah. I got it. Like, move it along.
I think Amanda's really... point maybe wasn't necessarily about, like, visuals, but in terms of plot. Like, what have they actually done that's
absolutely.
Bad?
But
yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not to speak for you, Amanda. Is that
so,
right?
Like, but,
was it so much that... I mean, we knew they were bad, but, like, why exactly are they,
right.
are they bad? Like,
exactly.
what have they done?
Yeah. And, like, I think that is just one example of all of these ways that the film, like, they were trying so hard to hit all of these plot points mm-hmm. that they completely lost the motivations and the why and the how. So it's just, like, plot point. We don't know why we're there. We don't know how we got here. We don't know why we care, but here we are. Like, that was my overwhelming feeling after watching the movie.
Amanda, your note is so exclamation point pretty, exclamation point two, exclamation point look at.
Yes.
Is there anything more to say about that sequential declarative, or how does that connect with what Jen said about how it looks in the visuals?
I think that they are making a stunning visual, like, not monstrosity. What's a good word for monstrosity?
Well, no, I mean, if we use, like, the architectural term, it's a brutalist movie. It's
yes.
a beautiful,
yeah. I mean,
brutalist
literally, the
movie.
The buildings are all brutal. Yes.
Yeah.
It's so pretty to look at. I think if I had muted it, I would have gotten the same out yes. of it in the
yes.
end. I would have known who was good and who was bad, like Jen
right.
was saying. I would have known the plot
That's
points because I would have seen
unbelievable point,
the worm.
Amanda. I love that point.
I wouldn't have had
to hear
any of it.
Because it does feel like moving concept art, like a Doug
yes.
Chang moving concept art book for Star Wars or something else.
Yeah, I mean, I loved looking at it. I enjoyed watching it. I think it's an interesting sci-fi movie. It's just a terrible character. Like, they're not given any... The characters aren't given anything to do. So
yeah.
everyone is set dressing. And,
yes.
And I think, you know, it just, like, it violates the first precept of storytelling, which is show, don't tell. You're told nothing. You're shown everything, except the stuff that you need to be shown, which are, like, details.
Right.
They shoved so much into 2 hours and 20 minutes that you end up... It ends up without any heart. Like, there's just
yes.
no... You know, like, Duncan Idaho has a heart. Mm-hmm. Keynes has a heart.
Yeah.
The stakes for everyone else, I kind of don't care about. I don't care what happens to the Harkonnens because I don't know what
right.
they did that's wrong. Like, the thing that we're told the Harkonnens do that are bad is colonize a planet... And then the Atreides go and colonize the planet.
Right.
So, like, how am I supposed to... Well, I don't care about these people. I care that, you know, a concubine and a husband and a son are going to die, maybe. Like, that's bad because people dying is bad. But I don't have any particular affection for
right.
anyone in this movie except the two characters who bring warmth because of their acting, not because
yeah.
of their
mm-hmm.
script. So,
or
yeah.
they were
Watch
allowed to do that, right? I mean, I'm sure if Villeneuve had given Isaac, like... go broader, he would have. That's clearly a choice on the director's part of like who has to stand there looking regal and who gets to like come out of the helicopter and whip their helmet off and be like, boy, that was quite a trip, wasn't it, boys? Like all that kind of vibe.
The only screen time you're given, you have to portray as much dignity as possible in order to be a foil to the person who portrays as much evil as possible with the screen time. Standing there rigidly looking noble is like all you can possibly do.
Yeah. I would just echo everything you both have said. I even found myself being mad at some of the lingering beautiful shots of spaceships landing, because I'm like, I'm missing plot because we need to look at how cool the ship coming over the horizon into this docking bay is. And no, make no mistake, there's one shot, and I don't even know what it is. I don't think it's in the book, but when like spaceships arrive in Arrakis, there's like this giant, huge Sonos speaker looking thing that then the little ships come out of, and I was like, I don't know what that is. It's beautiful, but I have no. Is that the thing they use to travel interstellarly? Like,
I think that was the guild ship. Yeah,
the guild ship. But like, I don't know what is going on there at all. And that there is such richness in the book, but you got to spend more time. You just time is the enemy here. And the things they chose to spend time on, even with their limited pieces, We're frustrating as someone who likes the book. And I think the very few people I've talked to who have seen it are having a very similar reaction. I think what they don't have is the underlying piece of what's missing, because they're like, it was beautiful and a cool hang and a visual cinematic experience unlike something you're going to have in a movie theater. It's so different, say, than Marvel movies, which have a completely different vibe, and rightly or wrongly. Now, I've seen 24 movies of that vibe, so I'm kind of good with the Marvel MCU vibe, you know, of the jokey seriousness, broing down even if you're a lady kind of stuff. That this was a curveball, but it could have been better. It just could have been better. And it wasn't bad enough to be a disaster to leave meat on the bone for someone else, almost, which almost would be better, like the Lynchian thing. But before we bury, well, I don't think we're burying it necessarily, but let's talk, is there anything that the movie does extremely well or even better than the book outside of visuals, or like Villeneuve's clear commitment to making the MoMA of science fiction movies?
Better than the book? No.
Or brings that's new. I mean, it doesn't have to do better, but like, what does it bring, anything new or different than the table than you were expecting or found in the book?
Rebecca Ferguson's portrayal of Jessica brought a lot more emotion. She had almost no lines, bless her, but she brought a lot more, you know, I think physicality, like physical expressions of emotion than you get from Jessica in the book. You get a lot of like, I don't know, like a Republican operative man writing a loving mother is like kind of a weird, it's like a weird flex anyway. But Jessica, I think you can tell, is a character written by a man, like written by a straight dude.
In the book.
And then when she comes onto the screen and like, you know, the opening scene when he's being tested by the Reverend Mother and she's just trying to not break down.
Yeah. That's a great point.
She says nothing except the fear is the mind killer prayer. Mm-hmm. And in the book, she also says nothing. She just stands there and is worried. I don't remember if she prays or not. But seeing her like buckle over and like hold her hands really tightly, all of that, I think that there was a new dimension to that character as a parent is lacking in the book that I didn't realize was lacking until I saw a human woman do it.
No, you're totally right. The portrayal that Ferguson gives is much more like it's costing Jessica to do this stuff. Where in the book, she's just sort of seeming like she's maybe herself a pawn within a pawn of the larger game, and kind of seems maybe not excited to let Paul be sacrificed to the Gamjabar, but at the very least sort of neutral. But you're right. Yeah. She has to hold herself together, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. And then when she tries to get him off planet, when they finally meet the Fremen and she's like, you know, smugglers, you have to get him off. She doesn't say that in the book. In the book, she's like, well, we're here. Like, this is part of the path that we have put ourselves on. But she breaks away to try to save him. And that moment is completely passed over.
Yeah. Jen, it sounds like you had some audiovisual stuff in watching this. Do you want to dwell on that for a minute?
You mean issues or?
Well, I just said, my note here is that I don't think it adds, in terms of if you were to describe on paper what's in the movie and what's on the book, they're the same thing in terms of sandworms and dunes and sunsets, but like just seeing it on the screen is different. A giant sandworm that's like 9 billion feet tall on the film is just way different than like, and there's a 400 meter sandworm. I'm like, okay, meters to feet, and what would that look like in my head? But on the screen, you're like, I don't have to do any of that math. But you had a note here that you had a hard time even seeing that?
Yeah, so I don't know if this is part of I mean, I have talked to a bunch of other people about what it was like to watch this movie at this point, and I literally don't know anyone who has seen it inside of a theater. I only know people who have seen it at home on varying size screens that would fit in your house.
Okay.
So, and like, no, nobody I know has an in-home theater. That I have talked to about this movie. So I saw it at a drive-in. Now, I am willing to believe that there are just certain fundamental issues of lighting that happen when you put a movie on the side of a cargo container out in a parking lot. Like, I believe that that's true. But everybody I've talked to has said, yes, the movie was very dimly lit. The problem with seeing it at the drive-in was that it was so dim in certain scenes that that moment of reveal where Paul and Jessica are confronted with the sandworm, it was just a wash of gray. We literally couldn't see.
I couldn't see it either.
Is that right? Okay. That's super interesting.
So,
yeah.
So yeah, I was like, it's supposed to be this moment, but I can't see what I'm looking at. And that happens so many times. And then audio. Yeah. Like, you know, there's this moment where, you know, Leto has been captured and Dr. Yue has put in the tooth and he's, you know, luring Baron Harkonnen closer to him so that he can say these words to him and then bite down. I could not tell what the hell he said. Mm. I could not hear it. And the score, the music score was so overwhelming in certain moments. Like, I can't tell what anybody's saying. So I don't know how much of that was. I mean, it seems to me that that's a real bummer, and it's not the first time we've seen that, like, memorably, the final episode or there was one Game of Thrones episode, right, that was
night.
So dark nobody could see it.
Yeah, the battle couldn't see it.
And like, this seems to be happening on the regular, and I'm like, do they not car test, like, in music you call it a car test, right? Like, it sounds great in the studio, now you put it on a cassette or a CD or whatever and you play it in your car on the crappy car speakers, what does it sound like? Do they not car test movies? Like, what?
It's a great question.
Especially if they're releasing it to streaming.
Like, exactly. It should look okay on a TV. In the age of streaming? Like, come on now. So I was very frustrated because I wanted to have these transcendent moments of, like, I'm finally seeing the thing, but I couldn't see it.
Yeah, my own viewing experience maybe is the exception that proves the rule in terms of, I saw it at home, but my one indulgence is I have a 75-inch OLED screen, so it's the million-to-one contrast ratio. So no better thing to watch something that's dark on. And I could see it, but I did have a thought of, I wonder what it looks like in a movie theater, because actually a movie theater doesn't have as good contrast ratio as an OLED, right? Because you have to, it's backlit projection, so there's light coming through and whatever.
Right.
That's a real disappointment because it is... My own experience was, I'm not sure I've ever seen a prettier movie. And Michelle said the same thing. I'm not sure I've ever seen the prettier thing. She also said the same thing. I think this is your note here, Jen, when you're talking about some of the things that don't go well. It's like, why do I care about these people? Or maybe it was Amanda.
Right.
Like, literally, why do I care about these people? Mm-hmm. Like, I just don't understand what's happening enough to care. And sometimes you don't need to understand plot to care about relationships, right? But then you need to have the relationships that is the connective tissue between it. But we just really... don't get that. The thing that struck me is I didn't have highlights and lowlights. I didn't have, this was sequence was awesome. Even the big sandworm that I did get to see, cause that's where I spend money. That's discretionary income. I was like, it was kind of what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like, that I'm almost inured to amazing special effects at this point. Like, after Endgame and some of the stuff I've seen in Star Wars, I'm like, okay, people can show me anything now.
Right.
So, a giant sandworm doesn't have the same, it's not, you know, it doesn't get to be the Jaws, the shark in Jaws, even in 1974. It just doesn't have a sense of how do they do that. It's like, you know, I know how they do that. They sit around and there's a bunch of people in Thailand at computers that they underpay to render this stuff. Mm. And that's how you do it. So I found myself pretty much overwhelmed by that. And nor did I really see lowlights. I mean, Josh Brolin screaming at Paul in their first training session. I'm like, okay, I don't like that vibe. But like, quotable lines, memorable sequences. Like, I just,
I have a low light.
It's so polished that I'm like, I don't know. I feel kind of inured to the beauty of it. I just don't feel it. It's beautiful, but I don't feel anything for it. But Amanda, follow up on that. You do have a real low light.
Oh, yeah. I had a ridiculous reaction to the shot of the Sardar Corps on their planet when the Harkonnen Mentat goes to, like, recruit the troops or whatever.
Yep.
And for some reason, the general or the leader of the Sardar Corps is speaking to them via mouth harp.
Yeah.
Like, what was that sound he was making? He was doing it like, burr, 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 burr. And I don't know what it was supposed to sound like, but all I could think about was, like, cartoons from my childhood of hillbillies with mouth harps. This is not what I'm supposed to be thinking. And then I couldn't stop laughing, which is not the reaction there. Like, you're not supposed to be laughing in that moment. These are supposed to be terrifying people. They're like bodies on a weird kind of Aztecian pyramid leading out from the night. Like, it's supposed to be this really dramatic moment, but they were so invested in kind of weird, quirky sound.
Right.
It totally pulled me out and I laughed hysterically. See, also bagpipes. Why were there bagpipes?
Yeah, can we talk about that for a minute? Because I don't remember. There were no bagpipes in the book, right?
I didn't think so.
It's 10,000 years in the future. We have better instruments.
Also, not the instrument you want on a sand planet, I wouldn't guess. Just a thought.
I felt like it was just a way to code them as white. And then I got mad.
Yeah, that was my theory too. But in my other note in that same, or my other drop in that same bucket is like the bullfighting imagery. Was that in the book?
Well, that's in the book.
Oh, that is in the book.
Yeah, it is in the book.
Okay.
We understand Leto to be of Spanish descent. I remember there being this moment of Lady Jessica being like, oh, I hate this portrait of your dad so much. And there's this giant bullhead over my dinner table and I just hate it. But like, Leto is super attached to it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was weird. I guess that makes sense because their home planet is like Caladan, which is like a barely skinned version of Catalan or something like that, maybe. Knowing
it's
Herbert,
like a mashup
to do
between
stuff like that.
Right, Catalan and Scottish like stuff, basically. Yeah.
I had if you could keep one element, what would it be? I think we've kind of all said the same thing. The visuals are striking. I'm not sure if there's anything else there. If you could change one thing, what it would be? Jen was like actual character development, which is like the biggest shade blow you can throw at a movie like this.
So this is something I wanted to bring up because I actually I talked to Devin, our colleague, who works in ad ops, about this because he told me that Denis Villeneuve is his favorite director. He loves Villeneuve. Mm-hmm. He was so excited to see Dune. And I was like, Devin, what do you know about Dune? And he said, oh, well, I've seen, you know, the David Lynch one. And like, I know the story, but I've never read it. But I was like so excited about Villeneuve. And I was like, well, what did you think? And he said, well, it was amazing. It was beautiful. You know, he said all the things everybody's saying. He's like, but you know, it left me cold. And that's something that's always true for me for Villeneuve. Like, and it made me think, I'm like, oh, that might be like not necessarily a miss, but an active choice. Like maybe
feature not a bug.
Is it possible that he just doesn't care about character? Like that what he's in it for is the plot and the visuals, and this is a very deliberate choice on his part.
I think it's entirely possible. You know, it's almost like the move towards non-representational painting, right? Like, I just want you to feel something when you look at this Rothko color field. I don't care.
Right.
I don't care that you're looking at actual people doing things in the real world. If it is, it's a weird choice then for something that's so complicated about character and everything. I don't know what you pick if you just want to have sort of a blank canvas to play with sci-fi visuals or any kind of visuals. I guess sci-fi is useful to him because it liberates him from the necessity of things being practicable in the world as we understand. It's like we don't care if a ship is shaped like that because why would it matter?
Right.
My note about that is kind of weird. It's similar, which is, there is some logic sacrificed for beauty, and you're going to laugh at me, I think. When the thing that bothered me the most, that I really attached, my barnacle of care that attached the whale, was, why is no one wearing sunglasses?
They have bagpipes, but not sunglasses in the future.
I mean, they've got still suits, but they can't give a brother a Ray-Bans when they're walking around out on the sun planet, and that's so that you can look at them because they're beautiful people.
Right.
It resists all logic, but you want to look at the blue eyes and you want to look at Chalamet's distinguishing feature as his bedroom eyes. You throw some Oakleys on that dude and he's just another high schooler with good cheekbones.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So that's the place where I really got stuck on. It's like, and then I was looking at the ships and I'm like, how do these things work? Exactly.
Right.
There's no discernible, they just look like whales or sand crawlers. There's no discernible reason. When they land, like just sort of they magically transform into something useful. And just the smoothness of all the operation. You know, one of the things that people say, and I agree with them about one of the reasons people are drawn oftentimes, especially in earlier versions to the Star Wars universe, is it feels lived in. It feels like there's scuff marks on stuff and people are dirty and the people are eating and they, you know, all the stuff that goes into it. Villeneuve doesn't really want the world to feel lived in. He wants it to feel pristine and polished. And I agree with you, Jen. I think maybe he made the film he wants to make. I don't know that he looks at it and he's like, boy, I wish I would have gotten more about the Mentats in there. I'm not sure that's the vibe he's really going for. in terms of now to his subsequent, it seems like it made an, they clearly made enough movie to want to proceed with it. Because it was also on HBO Max, it's a little hard to know, but even the box office did pretty well. Maybe we should end on this note, is like, is the future, to, now forget our own personal feelings about it, just for a minute. Do you feel like Dune is going to be a thing that's in the culture for a while? Like, we're going to, it's going to be, you know, we now have a Dune in our life. Because that's not what happened with the Lynch movie. It failed and it went away and it became only things that Jen's nerds had to pass a sci-fi test to have read. Does it have a chance of being like a Lord of the Rings situation where you don't now need to have read the books to have a Lord of the Rings vibe to be a fan of Lord of the Rings, which is kind of the ultimate test for these properties? What's your take, Amanda? You want to try a crack at that?
I think you still do need to read Dune to be in like any kind of real Dune fandom, because you can't have a conversation about it without, because you didn't get any information from the movie.
Right.
So I do think that it's going to be around, if only because the studios are going to force it upon us. Like, we'll get part two. Mm. And I say force it. I will watch part two. I'm like interested to see what they do. And it's pretty. And if part two does well, then they'll keep going, just like they did with Lord of the Rings. Will it be as profitable or as culturally like foundational to people as Lord of the Rings is? I don't think so. But I think that has more to do with Lord of the Rings being like how people connect with their subconscious desire to want whiteness to be a culture more than it does with the quality of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, body blows like at the end of the episode. Yeah. Here,
that's it's like a whole other rant. Yeah. If you're like super, super into Lord of the Rings and you're white, you might want to examine that.
Please be careful. Right. Yes, please be careful with that. Yeah.
And so I think because it doesn't have a... Because he doesn't do it. Like, it doesn't have the Mena actors. It doesn't have as much of the Islamic influence. He took it all out. There's, like, nowhere to sink a cultural connection into Dune. Like, you can't attach anywhere to it. You don't care about the people. You don't care about the culture. So, I don't know. I think it'll be a big blockbuster trilogy. Maybe it'll be like Ghostbusters. Like, it's a thing people watch because it's fun. And then do we care about
That's
it in 20 years?
Maybe not. Yeah, you know, you just said something that made me think about, like, say two people who haven't read the books get together and they've both seen Dune and they want to talk about. Like, what are they saying to each other about it? Like,
it's
what are you
pretty.
Talking about?
Did you see it. That sandworm? That's what they're saying.
Right. Yeah. They're not like, wasn't that guy funny or wasn't she awesome when she kicked ass or any of those kinds of things. It is very aesthetic experience. Jen, how about, what's your sense of, are we going to be really excited to do an Adaptation Nation about Dune in October of 2023?
I mean, I want to believe that we'll get more character development in part two because of what the plot of part two
has to be.
Well,
that's a great point.
I hope
like,
so.
I don't know how you do it without actually digging in at least a little bit to these characters. So it's possible that I will be happier at the end of that viewing experience, but I kind of don't. No, for sure. I mean, I will say, like, Villeneuve adapted Arrival, which is based on Ted Chiang.
Which you like, right? I remember
Story
this.
Of Your Life and Others. I think they made some weird-ass choices about changing the ending of that. The way that they did, like, this... I talked about that on another podcast.
Right.
But, like, I have some feelings about some of the changes that they made. But that you had to do the character development there, and he did. So I know he's capable of it. Mm-hmm. It's just, does he want to, and will he, are the big questions.
He prefers not to.
He prefers not to. Yes.
Well, in Arrival, it's harder to get distracted by giant sandworm vistas. In fairness, like, where are you going to go with Arrival? Well, maybe,
right. It's so contained, setting-wise. It's all the whole thing takes place in a room.
Right,
I mean, that's just true.
You don't have a huge, beautiful desert planet to have lingering shots over at the end. Yeah, and I mean, no spoilers except for really. But not only do you have to dig in, but this is the most normal, quote-unquote, of all the Dune experiences you're going to have in terms of where the plot goes. Like, welcome to Aaliyah's birth or conception or whatever that is, which, have fun with that. I just don't really know how that's going to go, but I'm also
You'll get an epic
filmmaker.
Space battle.
Yeah, we will get an epic space battle.
Yeah.
And sand battles. We already saw. We already saw some of the sand battles.
Desert power. If we have to say desert. Actually, that was a little bit of a hammy. It's a hammy line in the book, even, frankly, to talk about desert power. It's pretty tough. Well, I think that's all I have for you. My parting thought was, I'm glad it exists in the world. I definitely looked forward to it. And while I was watching it, I enjoyed watching it. It almost made me feel like I was drinking a Diet Coke, though. It's like, like it's enough like a Coke that I'm not mad at it, but you know, it's not a real Coke, which is maybe the most disappointing thing, because if it's an abject failure, then there is no part two done, and it doesn't become, someone else gets to do it. I mean, one of the bummer things about the Lord of the Rings adaptations being so popular is that who's going to remake it, right? Who's going to get another crack at this? And it becomes now the canonical version, which doesn't need to be necessarily. And this is now going to have so much cultural weight that it's a big story and you're going to do it differently. But I agree with you, Jen. I found myself desperately wanting it to be an 8-episode series, season one for book one, and really flip it around, because I think it could have worked really well. But you know what I enjoyed? I enjoyed this part. This part was super fun.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess we'll have show notes that will be available in your podcast catcher of choice. The show notes will be in the episode notes in your podcatcher of choice. So we'll take care of that there. Jen and Amanda, thank you so much for going on this journey with me. We started out with a really, really, really juicy topic. It's hard to know where to go from here for talk about adaptations, but we've got some ideas. Thanks so much.